Thank you very much, Henry. Is Gordon Tullock here? Yes, he is. Then I can say... Okay. I can say the one thing that came to my mind apropos your incidental remarks as chairman. Gordon, if that was your light, how dark must be darkness be? That you will recognize as a paraphrase.
I don't deny that the darkness is very dark.
Okay. Solzhenitsyn is now a celebrity. I'm not quite sure I welcome that. He is a man who has lived a most dramatic life and through a dramatic situation, as we got it in the repeated cartoons in which he was depicted as David and Goliath. There was the suspense of his personal story. Will they shoot him? Will they send him to a labor camp? Will they arrest him, put him in prison? Finally, he was exiled. There was a Russian touch of his personality, his refusal to leave Russia, the bitterness of his exile, his attachment to his wife and children. And yet, every journalist feels that this is not all. This is not all. And it was not merely the human interest of the situation that got our journalistic world so excited. There was no other figure of resistance against totalitarianism in our time. Not Bonhoeffer, not Niemöller, not Köstler, not Sakharov, not Pasternak, that have engendered the same kind of excitement, fascination, admiration, and ultimately hope, such as Solzhenitsyn has. Why? Let me just, as a background, pass very quickly in a sketch over the various phases of Solzhenitsyn's life. Mine may divide it into four periods, from his birth in December 1918 through his school in Rostov University, where he studied mathematics and physics. A year at teaching, then came army service. He was transferred to an officer school, served as a distinguished artillery officer until his arrest at the front, in the front lines, in February 1945, shortly before the end. The second phase began with his being sentenced to 8 years. First, he was in ordinary labor camps. Then he was transferred to a special camp, which he has described in his book, The First Circle, Marfino, a camp for scientists who engaged in research. Then he went again to an ordinary labor camp, this time in Kazakhstan, where he also was struck by cancer. Then he was released to exile, also in Kazakhstan, in February 1953, and the period of exile in Kazakhstan covered the period from 53 to 56. During this period, he suffered from cancer, was operated on for a while in a cancer ward, which he described in his book, Cancer Ward, recovered in a way that is not yet fully explained. And then followed the third period of his life, namely 56, his settlement in central Russia in a place called Tofopurduk. 57, his rehabilitation by the Soviet authorities in the course of the various de-Stalinization rehabilitations that took place, and his move to Ryazan as a teacher of physics. His remarriage to his former wife, who had divorced him during his period of imprisonment and had married someone else, and his publication of his story, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which occurred in 1962, some short stories following that. Then his writing of his book, The First Circle, finished in 1964, Cancer Ward 1966, and finally the persecution, his expulsion from the Writers' Union, the prohibition of further publications of his works. Neither Cancer Ward nor First Circle were published in Russia, although both were accepted by the Novy Mir. And finally, the Nobel Prize in 1970, and the publication abroad of his novel, August 1914. The fourth period is the final period of his persecution in the Soviet Union, with ever-increasing measures of intimidation. Slander was spread about him. He was harassed personally. Lectures were called off at the last minute. His friends were harassed and intimidated. And finally, of course, this culminated in his exile in February of this year. So much for the periods of his life. Now, if we talk about his accomplishments and the significance of these accomplishments, then the first thing that we must mention is not in the nature of a work that he has made, but is rather in the nature of his life. Please depict to yourself as a young man, went through officer school, went to war, and this was a horrible war. In Russia, a war fought without sufficient supplies, in which he marched more than 1,000 miles from central Russia into East Prussia, where he was finally arrested at the front, and from there right into prison camps, then cancer in the prison camps, then exile in Kazakhstan, which is Central Asia. A total period of 11 years of prison and exile, and 4 years of war. A period which reached from, you might say, almost his teenage to the time when he was an adult man, in which time he had never known peace, known nothing but hardship, had 1 year of marriage with his wife, never had known really settlement or happiness. And he came out of this. He came out of all this suffering, out of this horror. And the first thing that we note, that having now come to a little one-room hut in Kazakhstan, in a very poor village of Kazakhstan, where none of the people had enough, but looking around him, looking at the people, looking at nature, looking once again at his freedom, this man embraced life with a wholesale and all-encompassing love, a love which accepted everything around him, which accepted his fellow beings, which accepted his surroundings, which accepted all the years of his suffering. He never complained about having been in prison. Maybe it helped him that he never found himself quite free of guilt in the terms of the regime. He did admit that in his letters there were some things which the regime wouldn't tolerate, and so he accepted that he had not been imprisoned without cause. But the point is that this man now emerged from all these years of hardship, suffering, injustice, and so on, without a trace of bitterness. I think we ought to ponder this, because we live, Henry Regnery asked, why do we not produce people like this from our society? Well, we live in a society of plenty. We live in a society of freedom. Yet we look around ourselves, and whether we look among old or young, we find that we are surrounded by people who complain all the time, people who are malcontent, people who the keynote of whose lives has been and still is discontentment. And don't let's exclude ourselves. As a matter of fact, to some extent, our movement is a movement of discontent. I'm not saying that's not a movement of illegitimate discontent. But nevertheless, I simply want to say that discontent has become a keynote of our lives. And here we see a person who certainly would be entitled to some bitterness, and there is not a trace of him. So the first accomplishment is in Solzhenitsyn's is in his own soul. The first accomplishment is his accomplishment as a person. He emerged as a whole person. And as a whole person, he went to work on his writing, to which he had committed himself even before he went off to war. Now, the person of a writer is important, and in this case, I would say, is absolutely crucial, because he accomplished something which very few persons in our day and age in any country have accomplished as a person. But then, what a writer does in his books is that which is left behind him. And we have to look at his works and look at his accomplishments there. And here we find the same thing that I just spoke about in his life. Namely, Solzhenitsyn, the novelist, the story writer, a writer of stories set certainly in labor camps, set in the setting of Soviet Russia. Solzhenitsyn now goes ahead and in these works of his recaptures once again the full image of man, which again we in the West have lost, you might even say have forfeited for such a long time. Erich Vogelin coined the concept of the contracted self. A contracted self which came out of our intellectual work of the late 18th and the early 19th century and has now, in the 20th century, found its way into the common literature. And there we find it again, the fragment of a man. In our literature, it's very rarely that you find full persons. You find persons without heads, with holes in their body, persons all in pieces, all in fragments. You do not find a full person anymore. Our novelists, our poets, have lost themselves the capacity to see man in the fullness of all the relationships that belong to his soul, that belong to his existence. And here comes this man, Solzhenitsyn, who certainly in concentration camps, again, would be entitled to see man in fragments, decapitated, shorn from his limbs. And yet he comes out, and what he gives us in his books is a full man. Ivan Denisovich is a full man in the middle of his concentration camps. And so are the various persons of the first circle, and the various persons of Cancer Ward, the characters. And even the Soviet critics, who later on became hostile to him, asked themselves the question, why is it that when we see the description of this kind of life, as it is characteristic of this kind of setting, why is it that yet we are filled with so much hope? This is almost verbatim quote from one of the reviews of his Ivan Denisovich in the Soviet press. Well, the reason is precisely because every character that you find in Solzhenitsyn lives as a full person. And this is true even of his communists, whom he describes, whom he exposes to criticism by others, but whom he never deprives of their full humanity. Even they are men, and even they are men in the fullness of being human. Now, the restoration of the concept of full humanity is a tremendous chapter in the history of world literature. I already indicated very briefly when it began that we began to eliminate the fullness of a human person from our intellectual life and later on from our literature. I may remind you of a very significant book, The Drama of Atheistic Humanism by Henri de Lubac, the French Jesuit. Lubac draws a picture of our time, beginning with Feuerbach, Marx, Nietzsche, later on continuing with Auguste Comte. He calls it the drama of atheistic humanism, and he shows how, together with this atheistic humanism, the concept of man is lost from the thinking of intellectuals, from the mind of philosophers, and from all those who adhere to these philosophies and follow their lead. And you follow the description in Lubac of chapter after chapter. He comments on it, he shows you what's happening, and you might say, in the words of Charlie Brown, the plot thickens until it becomes hardly bearable. And then, you might say, the fifth act of the drama is the stopping of this tendency. The returning, the turning of the way. The one person who in his own person and in his work arrests this tendency of atheistic humanism and by his work puts out the resounding no to the continuing and continuingly successful work of the atheists. That man was, of course, Dostoevsky. Now, one gets the same impression in the history of world literature. If you want to get a similar book about literature, you can think of a book by Hillis Miller, The Disappearance of God, Miller describing the lives and the work of five ranking British authors, poets, all of whom struggled with the concept of God, all of whom saw God and their own grasp of God slip through their fingers in spite of their efforts. And again, now, Solzhenitsyn, the person who arrests this tendency, who stops, who, coming up himself in the communist ideology, he was persuaded of the justice of the revolution. He was on the side. He was never a member of the Communist Party, but he was on the side of the movement. And then finally, through his own living, and then through his literary work, coming back to the fullness of humanity and recapturing there all of the dimensions of humanity. And that is love, and that is nature. And that is God and faith, and leaving nothing out, because all this belongs to humanity. Leaving nothing out and seeing everything, everywhere, in all human persons. Now, there is another dimension to Solzhenitsyn. This would be enough. This would already be entitled him to a page in history. But there's another dimension, because unlike Pasternak and unlike Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn has expressed himself in another way, which began when the Writers' Union and the Soviet Writers' Union expelled him. First of all, curtailed him, and secondly, expelled him. He addressed himself to them, He called on the Writers' Union to establish freedom of expression for Soviet writers, the abolition of censorship, and then he laid down, from the point of view that he had recaptured in his writing, he laid down what should be the public order of Russia in the field of literary creation. And then he began to do this more and more when the Soviet newspapers attacked him, slandered him. He retorted in terms of letters which were never published in the papers, but which were published in Samizdat. He wrote his lecture, his Nobel acceptance lecture, which addressed himself to the problem of the freedom of the creative person. He wrote to Norwegian newspapers, in which he criticized not only Russia, but criticized also the West, and particularly the liberals in the West, for their double standards. We have still in memory the recent exchange between him and Sakharov about the long letter which Solzhenitsyn addressed before he left the Soviet Union, addressed to the regime, in which he exhorted them to drop Marxism, but also had all kinds of other postulates and requests for them. Sakharov disagreeing with him. I have some word about to say that a little bit later. At any rate, in all of these documents, which add up now to a good book, he was not any longer the novelist, not the poet, but he spoke pretty much like Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Jeremiah spoke to Israel. He was the prophet who spoke about righteousness, about goodness, about that wherein the regime and the life, way of living in the Soviet Union deviated from righteousness and goodness. He admonished them, he called them to task, he showed them the warning signs, and he told them, at this point you have to turn, and you have to turn in that direction. A prophet to his people. A prophet is one who is a warner, a messenger, one who reminds people of the eternal truth of life and calls them back to this truth. And as he showed, both by his Nobel lecture and also by his letter to the Norwegian newspaper, a prophet not merely to Russia, but also to the West, quite conscious of his role, taking his own role very seriously, and knowing that at certain moments he would have to speak. Now, he did speak as long as he was in Russia. I am not sure that he would still speak while he is in Switzerland, but what he has in Russia has said while he was still in Russia has already assured him of world historical stature in that his role as a prophet. Now, into this category, as a prophet, belong two of his literary works, namely August 1914 and the Gulag Archipelago. Because while these are literary works, they are also works, you might say, of the restoration of truth, of historical truth. I often run into the difficulty in the United States that Americans find it practically impossible to imagine what it means to live under a totalitarian regime. I have lived under a totalitarian regime. I would say possibly several of you who present are here share the same. And I can only say that I understand with all my soul that when the Russians say that nothing has impressed them so much in the works of Solzhenitsyn as that once again the truth was uttered, they once again saw the truth from which they had been separated for so long, to such an extent that they almost thought it didn't exist anymore, that it was this which opened their souls and lifted them up. And for this reason, the Gulag Archipelago, which tells the truth about the camps in detail, in a documented form, which is therefore, in the proper sense, not a literary work, but a reportage with utmost truth, and, of course, August 1914, which is an attempt to restore the truth of history from the rewritten history which is so characteristic of the Soviet Union. Both of these are the works of a prophet rather than of a literary man. The literary man speaks of the truth of the soul, the truth of daily living, the truth of experiences that everybody can share. But the prophet speaks also of the truth of history and the truth of righteousness. And so these two works then belong to the aspect of Solzhenitsyn, that is, the prophet. Now let me say a few more words about this issue of truth, because it is so very important to Solzhenitsyn, but I would say it's so very important to our time. And to us, the important thing is that we should understand what is at stake in Russia, what was at stake in Germany, in Italy, what is at stake in China now. The admonition which Solzhenitsyn left to the Russians shortly before he left was an admonition: let us now everyone speak the truth. It was a complex admonition. On the one hand, he said, we should restore the truth by getting, let us say, he said it, let us say 250,000, only 250,000 of the people who were engaged in the Stalinist period and its atrocities. Getting them to own up what they did and not to say anything more than we were wrong. And he pointed, Solzhenitsyn pointed, to the trials of former Nazis in Germany, and he said nothing like this has happened in the Soviet Union, although we have had the indictment of the Stalin period by Khrushchev. We have had the official detachment of the regime from this period and its atrocities. But we have not had individual acknowledgments of guilt. And he said it doesn't take any more than this. We would not have to put these people in jail or to death. All that it takes is that they acknowledge what they have done, and they acknowledge it was wrong. And then the other part of his admonition was, let us now each of us say only what he thinks. Not take part, not subscribe to any newspapers which indulges, or magazine which indulges in systematic lies, not take part in any official lie. And I had to recall the experience of Louis Feuer. All of you will remember him as a former socialist professor at Berkeley who got quite sobered by the experiences of Berkeley 64, left Berkeley, is now in Toronto. He had a grant to go to the Soviet Union, was in the Soviet Union for, I believe, 6 months or a year, and then had access to the meetings of the Leningrad Academy, and there was astonished again and again find that the meetings ended with monolithic unity of the Academy. No one dissenting, no opposition. Someone proposed, everyone said yes. Until he finally decided to speak to each of the individuals about their own position in this monolithic unity, and found to his astonishment that every one of these scholars and ranking scholars did not believe in what he had officially agreed to believe. So here was an example of the lie. The truth, therefore, is not the kind of an issue of sticking to the truth for purposes of individual advantage, but it's the official truth and the official lie. And all over the Soviet Union, there lies the burden of the official position, which all the people then hasten to conform to and hasten to support for reasons of cowardice or for reasons of being half-sold on it or else for reasons of opportunism. And this is the real issue, the corruption of the official life of society by the official untruth that is being enforced on the whole Soviet people. Now, this is the meaning of an ideological society. This is what is involved when we say ideocracy, the imposition of an ideology on all aspects of life, on all aspects of living, and then, of course, the habits of individual personal lying follow from this. And, of course, they are legion in the Soviet Union. They are proverbial in the Soviet Union. No one can be trusted in the Soviet Union. They lie habitually. But this is not what Solzhenitsyn means. What Solzhenitsyn means is the lying under official compulsion and under official guidance and for official purposes. And so the question which the problem which he really poses is a problem which has been among us through such examples as communist Russia, but also Nazi Germany. And Nazi Germany posed this problem to us before the Soviet Union did, because the Nazi dictatorship was brought to an end before the communist dictatorship has come to an end. And those of us who have looked at Germany with anxious, worried, personally involved eyes have all wondered, what does it take for a whole nation to repent itself of its sins? What form does national repentance take? Who is there to absolve a whole nation? How can a nation return from its falsehoods? This is precisely the cause in which Solzhenitsyn has now stood up as a prophet. And I would say, as a prophet, he has not significance not just for Russia. That is without question. He has significance for the world. Because all of us, of course, are involved in the kind of falsehood from which he is trying to recall the Russians. In his last letter to the Russians before he left, he said it, and quite rightly so. He said, the falsehood under which you labor is a Western falsehood. How true. How true. It is a Western falsehood. It was born in Germany and in France and in England, the three component parts of Marxism: German philosophy, French socialism, English economics. And it's not the only falsehood of this kind that was born in the Western world. And let us just reflect for a moment that the rest of the world, particularly Asia, came under our civilizational influence at that very inappropriate and unfortunate moment in our own history when our culture came under the dominance of our own ideologies all over the place. You just have to go to Japan and see how in Japan, a country with a very profound and rich culture, the entire Japanese intellectuals now, the intelligentsia, have turned positivist, have become alienated from their own cultural roots. They have not found any roots in Western culture either, because positivism doesn't allow of any roots. They have just been uprooted, and there they float as an uprooted stratum of leadership over the Japanese society. And the same thing is true of India. And in both cases, split national personalities result. So the situation to which Solzhenitsyn addresses himself is a worldwide situation, but of Western origin. And when we think of turning back from falsehood, it is from our own falsehood that we must be turning back. I'd like to end up with a few words about this last letter of Solzhenitsyn, about which there was so much controversy in the papers. Until that last letter of Solzhenitsyn became known, he was the darling of our liberals, was he not? And then he said a few words which read them in the wrong way. But the interesting thing was that not only our own liberals were rubbed in the wrong way, but also Sakharov. And Sakharov came out with a 4,000-word letter in which he detached himself from Solzhenitsyn on almost all counts except one, namely drop Marxism. With that, he said, I agree. And then it turned out that Sakharov, of course, was a conventional, ordinary Western liberal in the Soviet Union. No more, no less, as is Medvedev, or the two brothers Medvedev, are two. And it turned out also that Solzhenitsyn's position is not that of a liberal, not that of one who arrives at political views on a political basis, on the basis of a political ideological analysis. But his position is one who comes up from an experience of humanity and simply now tries to spell out what is it that we can do, that we could do under given situations in order to promote human living, in order to promote goodness, in order to promote a return to the fullness of human relationship that we must have in order to have some kind of personal fulfillment. If you look at the Old Testament, you will find that the old prophets said very similar things to Solzhenitsyn. They too addressed themselves to the political problems of the time. And insofar as they did, we must say their prophecies didn't come true. Isaiah said there will be a future in which the Egyptians and the Assyrians will live hand in hand and cheek by jowl, And there will be no more hostility between them. Well, the Assyrians went down to the Babylonians, and the Egyptians were conquered by the Persians, and his prophecy did not come true. But the point is that an immediate political prediction or immediate pragmatic advice is not the real significance of the message. The message lies deeper. The message in the old prophets was partly political to the time. It was partly humane and moral, in which sense it was universal and had to be taken with a good grain of interpretation, and of course partly it was eschatological, in which sense it could only be appropriated by those who had faith. Let us apply at least the first two of those to Solzhenitsyn and then realize that he is not a liberal, he is not a conservative, he cannot be subsumed under ideological headings. But at the same time, he belongs to the world. His significance is certainly in raising a mouthpiece, the voice of the Russian conscience once more. The Russian conscience, which is Christian, which is profoundly moral, and neither Christianity nor Russian morality have died out. And from the depth and from the rubble of this wasteland, which is the Soviet regime, there has come out this flower of Solzhenitsyn. And it's a flower that belongs to the whole world, to be enjoyed and to be cultivated by all of us.